All right, we're starting in Daniel chapter 7. And I want to point out something that you might not realize. You know, we don't often talk about the history of this thing. We start talking about the scriptures there. But you might not have realized that when Daniel was and taken back to the palace, while he was in the palace in the city of Babylon, Ezekiel, you don't realize, Ezekiel was in a concentration camp by the little river Kibar, or the little canal. It's not really a river. It's more like a stream or a canal. And while he was there, Jeremiah was still in the city of Jerusalem. But then later, and during that time, Jeremiah was forced out by the renegade Jews into Egypt. They didn't believe Jeremiah. They wanted to, you know, Jeremiah suffered a lot for preaching that Jerusalem was going to go down and Judah would be conquered by Babylon. So they probably, in all probability, knew each other's ministries. They knew each other's writings. And Daniel does refer to Jeremiah and the things that Jeremiah had prophesied the 70 years and so on. But I want to come to Daniel 10, 7 and verse 10. If you remember the last words of Daniel chapter 7 and verse 10, he says, the books were opened. The books were opened. Now, the truth is, it just says books. There's no the. There's no the. No definite article. Books were opened. Now, what kind of books were opened? The books were opened, and there are two books. The Bible records two of them. One is called the Book of Life. You've heard that before many, many times. The saints and the believers and all. And, you know, the earliest one reference we talked about last time was in the book of Exodus, where the Lord said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, because you remember what Moses said to God, but now if you will not forgive their sin, if not, then please blot me out of your book, which you have written. And God said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. Now, whether that's a literal book, we don't know. But I'm going to assume it is. Or is it a metaphor for God's, you know, enormous memories? Paul talks about that, about all these people who were his fellow workers in Philippians 4 and verse 3, whose names are in the book of life. He talks about, quote, the book of life. Rejoice in the Lord. Again, I say always rejoice. And why should you rejoice? Why should any of us who are Christians, who have dedicated to God, who have God's Holy Spirit, rejoice? Why we should rejoice? Because we're in God's book of life. And this is what Jesus said to the disciples. You remember in Luke chapter 10 and verse 20? Luke chapter 10, verse 20. Nevertheless, he says to the disciples, he gave them power over demons. He gave them power over to heal and so on as they went. And Jesus said to them, nevertheless, do not rejoice at this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are recorded in heaven. Jesus said that. And Paul said, yes, do rejoice. Now you have throughout the book of Revelation, I won't read them all because it's Revelation 3 verse 5, 13 verse 8, 17 verse 8, 20 verse 15, 21 verse 27. And I'll read verse 27, Revelation 21. And nothing unclean and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into the holy city. We're talking about that holy city. But only those, listen, whose names are written in the Lamb's book of life. The Lamb's book of life. So those, and we have that. Now there's that book, and then there's the book of remembrances. Book of remembrances, a book of deeds. You'll see it in referred to, which records evidently the deeds of humanity, positive and negative, all of our actions, positive and negative. You think, you know, people think they get away with things. Well, you're going to get away with this. You're going to get, nobody will ever know. Well, you know what? For every one of us, it's known. Unless you've come to God and had it absolutely obliterated by the blood of Christ, it's known. It's there. So let's take a look at Psalm 56 and verse 8, where David wrote, you have taken account of my wanderings You have put my tears in your bottle. It was like that bottle is a leather kind of pouch where they carried water, the kind of, you know, like the old days in the Western day. They didn't have a bottle like glass. They had like a pouch, you know. Are they not in your book? Are not all my wanderings, my tears, every time I got hurt, everything, all the things I prayed for, are they not in your book? And then he says, I'm going to read this in the same verse, 56, Psalm 56, verse 8 in the New English Translation. You keep track of my misery instead of wanderings, my misery. You put my tears in your leather container. Are they not recorded in your scroll, in your book, in your scroll? In Psalm 139, verse 16, we see, your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as there was not one of them. So David is saying, God wrote all, you know all the days. Now, there are many people, I don't necessarily subscribe to this, because I think we have a little bit of a duty to it. But I think that no matter how well you take care of yourself, no matter how well, there will be a day set. You cannot, you know, there's a day set when you will just not live anymore. That's the end of your days. And you know how it says all the days of so-and-so were so many years and so many months, and that's it. All the days of our lives, the days of our lives, the days that we come to a certain time in our life, and there are no more days. There are no more hours, no more minutes. It's all over. And so David says, your eyes, I'm going to read it in the New English, your eyes saw me when I was inside the womb. All the days ordained for me were recorded in your scroll before one of them came into existence. So does everybody? No, I think you can end your life sooner. I think you have a will to do so. You could eat badly. You can, not take care of yourself. You can do things that that shorten your life. You won't even make it. There are a lot of people, they don't make it. I've had clients, they were going along, they never made it to their 65th birthday or their 66th birthday, or, you know, they just didn't make it. Some people never made, 50. They died in their 40s. They had heart attacks and so on. They died before, way before their time. Isaiah 65 says, look, I have decreed I will not be silent, but will pay them back. I will pay them back exactly what they deserve. Now, this is God. How does he know what they deserve? He's recording it, you see. In Malachi, listen here, we have Malachi chapter 3, verse 16. Then those who feared the Eternal spoke to one another, and the Eternal gave attention and heard it, and it says, a book of remembrance was written before him. A book of remembrance for those who fear the Eternal and who esteem his name. So God keeps track of both our good and our bad deeds, all the things that we do. And of course, in Revelation 20, you see in verse 12, and I saw the dead, small and great, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Not the books, but just books. Books were opened. And another book opened, which is the book of life. So you have two books. Books were opened. Those are the books of your remembrances, the books of your miseries, the books of your wanderings, the books of your deeds, both good and bad. And another book was opened, the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds. This is the book of remembrances. So you have two sets of books. And God is just. God is not going to just, do this to you without, without giving you a chance. And in verse 13 of 20, of Revelation 20, and the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and the death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them, Hades meaning the grave, the underworld, and they were judged. Everybody was judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. So these are references to books. They may, as I said, they may be metaphors for God's memory. On the other hand, it seems to imply, you know, that God is going to, there's a judgment coming, and God is just. He's a just judge. He's not going to judge you on the basis of hearsay. He's not going to judge you. He's got evidence. He's got the evidence. He's got it all collected. And we all have to stand before the judgment seat of God. Books were opened. Now, in Daniel chapter 7, I'm going to read on here. And I kept looking because the sound of the boastful words of the horn that was speaking, I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and was given to the burning fire. So in verse 11, we know the end of the story, don't we? We all know what the end is. God wins. Satan and the beast, the false prophet, and all the evils lose. That's the end of the story. We know how that's going to turn out. And as for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. And I kept looking in the night visions. This is verse 13 now of Daniel 7. And he beheld the clouds of heaven, one like the Son of Man, coming to the Ancient of Days. We talked about that last time. We're coming all the way down now to verse through these things. The everlasting kingdom, again, we talked about that in verse 15. As for me, Daniel, my spirits were distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. I mean, he's seeing all this in his mind's eye, and he's just kind of bothered by it. Have you ever watched, and I try to avoid, I do not like horror movies. I almost never watch them. I won't watch them. I don't like the music in them. I don't like a lot of stuff. I just don't like eerie stuff. But anyhow, but if you've ever watched one when I was a kid, you know, watched Frankenstein, it's hard to get that out of your mind. You know, just like, uh-oh, is the Wolfman going to get me? And all that stuff. It's hard to get it out of your mind. So I like to protect my mind from these kinds of evil. I approached, now in verse 16, here it is. One of the characteristics, let's take a look. I approached one of those who were standing by, and I began asking him. Now, one of those who are standing by are angels. These are the angels who, I began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me, and he made known to me the interpretation of these things. Now, one of the characteristics, and I won't have to point it out, are that angels do the interpretation. You see it in chapter 8. You see it in chapter 9 of Daniel. You see it in Zechariah 1. You see it in Zechariah 2, in Zechariah 4, in Zechariah 6. You see it in Revelation 5. You see it in Revelation 7. There are angels who make interpretations and tell the prophet or whoever's receiving this revelation what's going to happen. They come in and take it. See, so this is another way that God shows he is in complete control. Sovereignty. He has total sovereignty. No human being can know the true interpretations without a revelation from heaven above, from the angel, from God. You have to have that. You won't know these things unless God tells you. So the angels help the prophets. So God, the God-inspired visions and dreams are given to communicate truths from God, but they are still under God's control. Only some get to understand. You know, you've seen it before. You've seen Isaiah. Let's take a look at why everybody doesn't get to understand. Isaiah chapter 6, verses 9 and 10, a very famous verse, which Jesus quoted in the New Testament. He said, go and tell the people, keep on listening, but you do not perceive. Keep on looking, but you do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive. Render their ears dull and their eyes dim. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand their hearts, and return and be healed or forgiven. Healed or forgiven. So that was, then you see in Isaiah chapter 43, the Bible talks a lot about people that don't understand. Bring out the people who are blind even though they have eyes, and the deaf, even though they have ears. Isaiah 43, verse 8. Isaiah 43, verse 8. Jeremiah 5 and verse 21. Now hear this, O foolish, senseless people, who have eyes but do not see, who have ears but do not hear. Well, that's, how do we take in knowledge? Now you have five senses, okay, five of them. You have five senses. You have seeing, hearing. These are the two prime ways of learning. You have sense of touch. That's also a form of learning, especially for little kids. They have to touch things and learn. We also learn through touch. Then you have the sense of smell and the sense of taste. So there's your five senses. And these are the way we take in the world. We take in the world and all the information that we have around us through these five senses. But the primary ones for learning God's truth, for learning the Bible, the truth, the words of the Bible, are seeing and hearing. You have to see it, you have to hear it. You read it, and you have to hear it read. You have to hear it. So when you have eyes that don't see, ears that don't hear, you know, this is bad. Ezekiel chapter 12 and verse 2. Son of man, you live in the midst of a rebellious house, he says to Ezekiel. This is God speaking to Ezekiel. Who have eyes to see but do not see, ears to hear but do not hear, for they are a rebellious house. See? They are a rebellious house. You see, God's revelation, when God reveals things, if you're rebellious against God, you're not going to understand God's word. You're not going to understand God's truth. God's revelation is for God's people. This is God's book right here for God's people. This is the Holy Bible. It's God's book for God's people. That's who has it. And to understand it, you have to be submissive to God. And remember what Jesus said. Now, when he gave this parable, you remember, of the sower, and the disciples came and said, you know, and he was saying to them, this is Mark chapter 4 and verse 9, and he was saying to them, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. And as soon as he was alone, the followers, his followers, along with the 12, began asking him about the parables, you know. And he was saying to them, to you it has been given the mystery of the kingdom of God. But to those who are outside, they get everything in parables. So that, and now he's quoting, so that while seeing, now he's quoting Isaiah, so that while seeing they may see and not perceive, and while hearing they may hear and not understand, otherwise they might return and be forgiven. That's quote from Isaiah. So that's why God does it. If you're not tremendously, I mean, you're not truly submissive to God, God's not going to give you these revelations. All right, let's go to Daniel chapter 7 now. You see the great beast, and I approached those, and he gave me the exact meaning of this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. These are great beasts which are four in number, and the four kings will rise in the earth, but the saints of the highest will receive the kingdom and possess. So we know the end of the story. The saints are going to win, okay? The saints are going to win this game. We know it. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom, possess the kingdom forever from all ages. Then I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast. That's what Daniel was, because it was so different. Which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, and its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the 10 horns that were on the head, and the horn that came up, and so on, the three of these horns. So he's looking in verse 18, the saints of the Most High. Once again, we're reminded of the connection. Here's the connection. You see, when God talks about, you know, the kingdom of God, the God, will establish an everlasting, the Ancient of Days, the Most High, will establish an everlasting kingdom. When you see the Son of Man in the book of Daniel, chapter 7 here, and verse 13, you remember? I kept looking at the Son of Man. He comes to the Ancient of Days, and the Son of Man will receive glory and his dominion, an everlasting dominion. So you have a connection between God, the Father, you might say, the Ancient of Days, the Son of Man, the Messiah, and the saints. What does this verse 18 say? The saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom. And that will, they're all three connected because they're all three part of a kingdom that will last forever and ever and ever. And that's what you see here. And they win. All the others lose. Okay? I'll just read all the way through now. Because we pretty much covered Daniel 7. I kept looking, and the little horn was waiting in the saints, and he was overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came. In verse 22, listen to this verse. In verse 22, and this Ancient of Days came, and judgment was passed in favor of the saints. So we know the end of the story. He's telling us the little horn is going to go after God's people, but God is going to save them. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. And the fourth beast in verse 23 will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, will devour the whole earth, tread it down, and crush it. As for the ten horns out of the kingdom, the kings will rise, and another one will rise after them, and they will be different from the previous ones and will subdue the three kings. He will speak against the Most High, that little horn. He will speak against the Most High. He will wear down the saints of the Most High. He will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and he will be given and be given into his hand for a time, time, time. They will be given into his hand for 3.5 years. But the court will sit in judgment, and his dominion, that fourth beast, will be taken away. We know, once again, over and over and over in the book of Daniel, you get the idea. Who wins? Saints win. The Messiah wins, the Father wins. Then sovereignty, verse 27, and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest, the Most High, El Elyon, the Most High. His kingdom will be for an everlasting kingdom. And all dominion will serve and obey him. And at this point, the revelation ended. That's when, here's Daniel. He's listening to this angel. At this point, as for me, Daniel says, this is verse 28, very interesting. As for me, Daniel says, my thoughts were greatly alarming me. And my face grew pale. Just stunned. This is all going to happen. This is the, and here I am in this kingdom of Medo-Persians and so on. But I kept, no, this was still, he was still in Babylon. Remember, this is in the first year of Belshazzar. And I kept the matter to myself. I didn't talk about it with anybody. I didn't say it to anybody. I didn't go out and tell Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Once again, we see this use of the eternal nature of the kingdom. And this is not the millennium, okay? The kingdom is not the millennium. The kingdom is forever. Millennium is 1,000 years, unless you want to say that the 1,000 years are a metaphor for, you know, forever. Maybe it's a metaphor for the eternal kingdom, but usually people talk about the millennium then, because in the book of Revelation you see the 1,000 years, because after the 1,000 years were finished, then Satan was released. So this can't be the 1,000 years. This cannot be the millennium, because the kingdom of God goes forever and ever and ever. It's an everlasting kingdom. And I'm going to have some things to say about the kingdom of God during the feast. One of my sermons during the feast is called The Essentials of the Kingdom. You might be surprised what the Bible has to say about it. Daniel chapter 8 now. Now Daniel chapter 8 returns to Hebrew language. Beginning in verse 4 of 8. I saw the ram. Okay. Now, verses 1. In the third year, third reign of Belshazzar, the king. Now, again, we already saw that Daniel was thrown into the lion's den under the Darius, the Mede and the Persians, based on the law of the Medes and Persians. Remember, that was in chapter 6. So Daniel here in chapter 8 is out of time order. He's talking about the reign of Belshazzar. That was the grandson of King Nebuchadnezzar. He was still in Babylon. They had not. Remember, it was that night, on that one night that Belshazzar was killed himself when the Medes and the Persians came in and captured Babylon. So chapter 8 is out of sync, okay? But it starts now with Hebrew languages in verse 4. Okay? Beginning in verse 4, the Aramaic language was used in the writing, a lot of the writing of Daniel. But in chapter 8, Daniel goes back to Hebrew in the writing. While the original language of the Old Testament was mainly Hebrew, there are a number of places besides Daniel, not just in Daniel, but besides Daniel, where Aramaic was used. Now, Jesus spoke Aramaic to some people. You know, when he says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that's Aramaic for my God, my God. Now, some people standing by didn't understand it. Maybe they thought it was something else. They was calling for Elijah. As you know, Eli is, my God is Yah, my God is the eternal, Yahweh. My God is Yahweh. And Eli, Eli, they thought maybe he's calling for Elijah, but he was saying, my God, why have you, lama sabachthani, why have you forsaken me? That's all Aramaic. Now, so the Hebrew language, the original language, of course, was Hebrew, but here are the few places. If you want to know, here are other places where Aramaic is used in the Bible. You don't have to know this because you probably don't. You're reading an English translation, so you're depending on other people who read the Aramaic. But there are places like in Ezra chapter 4 and verse 8, all the way through Ezra 6 and verse 12. Ezra chapter 7, verses 12 through 26 are all in Aramaic. Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 11 is in Aramaic. And there's one word in Genesis chapter 31 and verse 47 that's also in Aramaic. So people go, the scholars go over these words. I'm not a scholar to go over these words, but this is what the scholars come up with. So when the whole book of Daniel, however, is considered, you can see that the book of Daniel is not in chronological order. So here's the chronology, if you want to look at the way we can put it together. The chronology of the book of Daniel goes like this. Chapter 1, then chapter 2, then chapter 3. We know what chapter 1 is. That's when they are brought to Babylon and they ask for a pulse and please don't make us eat the king's goodies and so on. Chapter 2 is the great image that King Nebuchadnezzar sees. Chapter 3, he says, is about the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that will be thrown in the fire. And then chapter 4, you know, we come there. Those four, right in a row, that's when Nebuchadnezzar is, you know, driven from humankind in there. So chapter 1, 2, 3, and 4, they're in chronological order. From there, we skip to chapter 7. Because chapter 7 was written during Belshazzar's reign, in the first year of Belshazzar. Then chapter 8, which was written in what? The third year of Belshazzar. Then you go back to chapter 5 of Daniel. You go back to chapter 5 of Daniel, which is Belshazzar's feast. And that's the last year of Belshazzar. That's when he's going down and out. And then you go to chapter 9 after that, which you have where Daniel is praying. Then after that, you go to chapter 6, where Daniel is now in the Persian Empire and was thrown almost into the lion's den. And after that, you go to chapters 10, 11, and 12. They're all in chronological order. So the book of Daniel is not written, all the chapters, in chronology. That is, in time things. So this is the way it is if you're going to take a look. But Daniel is putting this all, you can see that he's not putting this together haphazardly. He wants us to see certain things and understand. Now, he tells you the time. This was in the third year of Belshazzar. He says that in chapter 8. Okay? So in chapter 8 and verse 4, he said, I looked in the vision, so I was looking. I was in the citadel of Susa, which is by the province of Elam. And I looked, and the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. And so it's a canal. So in verse 2, I'm reading for the New American Standard Version. Verse 3. Then I lifted my eyes and I looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, and with the longer one was coming out. So you have these two horns. I saw this ram. And in verse 4, I saw the ram budding westward, northward, southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. Now, we know, as this continues, that this ram here, this particular ram, was the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire came out. It was budding its way here and there. Okay? And while I was absorbed, now, so he was budding in this prediction. So the prediction here is, it reminds us how this beast was going. But then let's take a look at verse 5. While I was observing this ram, you know, it was like a sheep's ram. Then he says a male goat came. So you have the male sheep, which was a ram, you know, and now you have a male goat, which was coming from the west, over the surface of the whole earth, without touching the ground. Listen to how the description. This male goat is coming so fast, it's flying, it's virtually flying, not even touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes, right there between his horn is coming. And he came up to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him with a mighty wrath. And I saw him beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns. So here's a ram with two horns, one larger. The interpretation in history would be the best interpretation so that we have based on the history. Was it, and based on what he says here, it was the Persian Empire, and one horn was longer than the other. Probably the Persian, the Medes were not as powerful as the Persians, and the Persians took over, and they were the stronger of the two. And the Persians did. They did a lot of conquering there. But you have to be careful. Okay? We just have to be careful. And as you read this, you see this ram coming so fast. He plunges into this goat. I mean, the goat coming so fast, he plunges into this sheep ram and destroys the horn. See? And I saw him beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him, so he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram. That's all the way in verse 7. Okay? Now, it looks like here came Greece, here was Persia, here came Greece, wham! I'm going to just fly to the and hit him with my horn and destroy him just like that. I'm going to just kill him just like that. Well, in fact, that's just not quite the way history was. It's going to be a lesson for us to understand. You cannot use these apocalyptic statements about all these things and make it out to the very, you know, that's the way it was. These are generally, yes, Greece did conquer Persia. Here's the truth. Greece did repel Persia, and Persia had advanced. The reason Alexander the Great was so angry, he was really angry with Persia, is because Persia had attacked Greece several times. Remember, Persia is going this way and that ram in verse 5 is going here and going there. In verse 4, he went northward, he went southward, he went this way. No other beast could stand before him. He was very powerful for a while. But then here came this goat. And that goat with that horn between his eyes, that horn is generally recognized as Alexander the Great. So here's what happened. Greece did repel Persia several times between 490 B.C. and 480 B.C. Persia came in, and Greece repelled. Persia attacked it again. It wasn't that just Greece just whammed over Persia. So apocalyptic literature cannot be interpreted or evaluated by the very detail of that picture. Often, the detail they have significance only after we understand the fulfillment of history. We understand it. So Daniel chapter 8 and verse 5, the male goat coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth, not touching the ground. Absolutely, this refers to Greece, because you'll see it in chapter 8 and verse 21. What does it say? The interpretation, the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes, the first king. The first king was Alexander the Great. And he conquered and conquered and conquered. So we see the interpretation of the Greece. And the direction from Alexander the Great, he came from the west, you see. The parallels, this also parallels the leopard with the four wolves, see in chapter 7 and verse 6. The leopard was also Greece. The surface of the whole earth. No, he went to the surface of the whole earth. Did he really go over the surface of the entire globe of the earth? No. It meant, it's just a hyperbolic statement, meaning the then known world. The then known world refers to that. And Daniel 8 and verses 6 and 7, he rushed at him with a mighty wrath, and he was enraged with him. Well, we know Persia, under Darius III, attacked Greece several times, as I said. This Greece was so angry that when Alexander crossed the narrow gap of the water in 334, it didn't take long. I mean, let me tell you how vast these armies were in those ancient times. Human beings had multiplied on the earth. Alexander took 30,000 soldiers and 5,000 cavalry on horses. He engaged the Persian army with over 600,000 soldiers eventually and soundly defeated them. You know, and he did it several times because Persia didn't just go down at once. It wasn't just wham, you're down and you're out. It was, they fought. Persia was a world ruling empire. And you come at it, it's going to fight. It's going to fight. And Alexander the Great hit him several times with enormous forces before Persia went down. So if one reads just chapter 8 alone, one would expect one decisive battle. But in fact, there were three major decisive battles. Okay, now the prediction is true, but the details from what you read here are fuzzy, you know. And they're what we call apocalyptic details. You can't use them completely all the time in a way. Okay? Yes, Daniel 8, verse 8, the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. That's true. The large horn was broken off, and in place came the four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. This refers to the death of Alexander the Great in 323 B.C. In Babylon, he died at the age of about 32 or 33 years old, and it was caused by swamp fever. He died of a fever. The unexpected sudden death of Alexander the Great prolonged the conflict throughout his kingdom. The governors then took over, and it was split in various ways. But there were four leading ones. The kingdom fell into the various regional satraps, you know, like governors, and you had one in Asia, one in Greece, one in Egypt, one in Macedonia, one in Thrace, one in Bithynia, one in Pontus, one in Babylon. Of those, the most that the Bible talks about is Ptolemy in Egypt and the one in Syria, okay? The Seleucids in Syria. Syria, Babylon, the one that was up closer to Babylon, Seleucus. These were the ones that were the most powerful. So of these eight, you would have probably the one from Asia, the one from Egypt, the one from Syria, and I think you had the one from either Thrace or Macedonia was the fourth most powerful. All right, we will stop here.